welcome. It's time for the Image Doctors Photography Podcast. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And we're back in the mountain hideout, right?
hideouts.
But yeah, for those of you who are watching the news, we got about 2 feet of snow in Colorado over the weekend. It was
pretty
crazy. But you know what? It's already mostly melted from my front yard when I look out the window here. So yeah, it's kind of amazing what solar radiation has the powers.
It works well here.
It does.
It's melts not fast. Like some places in the country where it snows and then hangs around until spring.
Yeah. So although we are now officially through our first day of spring, so
we are.
So that's always nice too. Anyway, thanks again for everybody who tuned in last week where we talked about Cuba, and our bonus video is out now, so our supporters can watch us get some more info on shooting Cuba. Plus we go through some of our photos that we enjoyed and talked about how we processed them and that kind of stuff. So that bonus video is out and it is available on our blog, imagedoctorsphoto.com.
Mm-hmm.
All right. This week, as we promised, we're going to talk about the OM-1 Mark II, which we've had an opportunity to handle.
Yep.
Very briefly.
Yeah, but we both have had several days time with them and some differing shooting experiences.
Digging out for 22 inches of snow wasn't really a great one.
Yeah,
but
you know, we're not starting from zero. We're both pretty experienced with the OM-1, so that helps quite a bit. And then also, as promised, and we'll do this first, we'll talk a little bit more about the DxO Pure RAW 4 software release that came out. It's a paid upgrade.
Yeah, it came out a few weeks ago. So let's talk about this. We both use the product. This, and just to recap, you mentioned it last week a little bit too. This is a tool that allows you to use a different processing engine for RAW files. It will then save them in any number of formats, but the one we use is the DNG format,
mm-hmm.
which is then read by products like Lightroom, Camera Raw, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest difference is that it uses its own its own engine for demosaicing, for noise reduction, and for detail enhancement, as well as lens corrections, vignetting, distortion, mm-hmm. Chromatic aberration. So when you pull your file in, those tools will have been applied. And the only caveat, really, what I would say with using it is things like detail settings get baked in. You know, they're in your RAW file now. It's what's called a linear RAW file. Mm-hmm. So even though it's RAW, even though you can edit normally, you can always add the sharp. You're not going to get undo the sharpness settings, for example. But what we have found with version 3 was that its noise reduction, which is now AI based, nothing short of awesome.
It is really, really good. And you know, if I were going to describe it up until version 3, I'd say great noise reduction. When it's set correctly, the sharpening is pretty good. And it makes for a very simple, very nice workflow in Lightroom, particular, since you can create the DNGs and work with them just like any other RAW file. Mm-hmm. So that was the case up until this point. For me, the big improvement in version 4 has to do with being able to preview those sharpening settings.
Yes.
Because that was something that drove me nuts, because they truly are not standardized.
Right.
They vary all over the map, and there are some camera and lens combinations where you need to use standard, some where you need to use soft, some where you need to turn it off. And that's just to get the same result, which is crazy. So it's hugely better to be able to preview them at least the first time that you use them, and then you'll know, and you can just kind of stick with it.
The user interface has been radically overhauled in that regard. So you have now two options if you're launching this product, say from Lightroom,
mm-hmm.
as a plugin option. One option is the old school way, where you just get the dialog box. You can change the settings based on whatever you think you need. And if you already know what settings you want, that's super easy. And then you just go and it works like the old way. The other option is to get a preview. And that's where you get the before and after. You can zoom in and you can look at the effects of the sharpening and really see what it's doing. It's slower, of course, because you got to redraw previews, but it's extremely useful when you're looking at shots from like a camera where you don't know, okay, with this lens combo, what do I want to do? I mean, you've told me about some images where you sent it out and the picture just came back so oversharpened, you had to turn it off altogether.
Yeah.
So being able to shut that off or make those different settings on the fly can be extremely helpful. And
the
so
good
I
news
like
this. Is you figure out one camera and lens combo setting. That's what you can just go with from that point.
Exactly. And you can do batch output from Lightroom. You can select 20 mm-hmm. pictures and have them mm-hmm. processed. And it's not something, and we've said it before, we don't use this on every photo, but on photos that you've gotten, let's say ISO 3200 and higher, it's very good at what it does. And they've even updated their engine. Version 4 has a new AI engine, I believe, deep whatever, something.
Yeah, it's XD2, I think. And unfortunately, it doesn't work on Fuji X-Trans files yet. So, for example, we got back from Cuba and, those were the kinds of files I had. I couldn't use the new feature for that. It just ran with the old one, mm-hmm. which is still quite good. I did try it with some other images, like some Sony ones, and I can't remember what else. Things that weren't X-Trans sensor based. And what I noticed is for the new engine, it does do a better job than the old one at rendering really fine detail. So goodness, and it didn't seem any slower. It seemed about the same speed.
Well, let's
so
just say it was
useful.
It was already evident for me that it was worth the paid upgrade. No argument here.
To me, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that's really good to have in your toolkit, especially if you do a lot of high ISO shooting. Then it's mm-hmm. almost mandatory. It's just very good. Okay. That is what we had to say. You can find that, of course, at dxo.com, I believe, and just download. Do they have a trial version?
I'm sure they do.
Yeah, they usually offer something like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now, a couple weeks ago, or about a month ago, we talked about the release of the OM-1 Mark II from OM System, OM Digital Solutions, whatever they're, I get
so too many names.
With apologies to you guys at OM Digital Solutions. And we kind of looked at the spec sheet and had some sort of mixed feelings about, how much of this stuff is really needed. Not that the improvements aren't welcome. It's just, would it be worth upgrading? Now, we both got our hands on this camera just recently. So we've had them for about, less than a week, but we've done the things that from our perspective were what we wanted to see, because there were some specific, there were some specific things that we wanted to see. It's one thing to say something has been quote improved. It's another thing to experience those improvements and see how they really, if they make a difference in what you shoot.
Mm-hmm.
So, because the fundamentals between the Mark II and the original are very minimal. There's very few differences in terms of the way the camera operates. There was nothing radically different about the design, same sensor.
The body is identical.
Yeah, it is the same.
So you can use the same vertical grip with it, which is nice. No changes there. A very subtle thing is they put rubber on both the rear control dial and the front one. It's nice. I honestly didn't have big problems with it before. It'll probably be a little bit better with gloves.
It does feel a little bit better, but this is a minor thing.
It's a nit.
Right. So what we want to do is we want to talk about the major areas that we wanted to try because they are important to the styles and subjects that we shoot. And mm-hmm. then at the end, we'll just talk about, the upgrade proposition is, as to how do we see it and whether that's views have changed on it. So where do you
want
to start,
Rick? I'm going to start with something simple and global because we both heard comments from ambassadors and other people saying, oh, it just feels much more responsive and agile. I think it feels the same.
In terms of overall operation, I would.
Yeah, and that's not a dig. it felt very responsive before.
Right.
And it still does.
And I haven't tried enough use cases yet to, you know, again, being stuck inside with a snowstorm didn't help my test criteria. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I did go out to the local wildlife area to shoot some birds at the different bird feeders. Thing. And that's a different thing. So we'll talk about that. So for us, you know, there were sort of three major areas or three or four different things that were on the spec sheet we wanted to look at. So one was they've changed, and let's talk about this one first, face and eye detection.
For people.
Yeah, human face. So first thing they did was, well, there's two pieces to it. One is that they revamped the algorithm. And so that's one of those things that until you try it, you don't know how much better or worse it is. And the other thing they did is they moved it from a separate setting into the list of subject detection options, which was a welcome change.
Yeah, it makes it a little bit simpler switching back and forth. So you just go from human to animals to birds to, you know, go down the list. There are a whole bunch of them.
And what that does, in my opinion, it has a little ripple effect, is that it enables you to change some of your custom button configurations, because no longer do you need a button to assign to say turn face eye off. You have that under the same unified set of controls. So that's a nice thing, just ergonomically speaking, and turn it on. The other thing that it did, though, is it now looks at the AF area, what they call the target or the AF pattern or the zone. And it looks for faces there first, even though it might see other faces in the viewfinder. And then it allows you to pick the face and just simply lock onto it very easily. So that's a cool thing. Mm-hmm. But the biggest thing I think we would both agree, and what I thought you would like the most from this camera, was the improved algorithms. Wouldn't you agree?
In terms of how it handles people. Correct. And that it's not just looking at the face and eyes, it's looking at the body and using that to first acquire a focus or a subject. And that's a good thing, because it's not just that initial acquisition, it's what if the subject turns their head? And that was a problem before. And you saw that a little bit in Cuba, right? Using the original OM-1, right. I was using a Fuji X-T5 that had been improved via firmware updates to handle that much better. And in my case, someone could be in profile, and the only thing that you would see regarding our eyes were eyelashes, and the darn thing would lock right on them perfectly. Right. So, and I'm not kidding. I had like 100% success rate with that camera down in Cuba with face and eye detect. It was just incredibly good.
What I see, or what I saw, and you can you can choose to chime in on this with the original camera, was that if you were doing staged portraits where mostly front three-quarter view, eyes open, the OM-1 did pretty well. It finds eyes and does that. As soon as you get into things like profile or eyes closed or maybe glasses, it would sometimes fail. What does that mean? Now, all of a sudden, the camera is, you're forced to use the traditional, whatever the focus option that you have selected is, and that can be problematic. For example, in Cuba, it did not want to find the singer's face. She had her eyes closed and she had a microphone in front of her mouth. So we are on one of the trips we did.
Right.
And there was someone sitting in the back of the auditorium looking directly at us. And you know what that camera saw every time I turned face eye on? Was that person in the back, and that's what it wanted to focus on. It did not matter to the camera how many times I put the focus area, you know, over the person right there. So what did I have to do? I had to turn face eye off and focus the regular way. And then what happened? It focused on the microphone in front of her face.
Yeah. Conversely, I was shooting the same subject with the X-T5. It just went right to the eyes every time.
Exactly. And that's
and
what I
that's
believe.
That's the way the Mark II appears to be working.
Bingo. And if you got multiple people in the frame, you can do things to toggle between them. But what I just do is use a smaller AF target area, point at the person you want, click lock, and stays locked on. So the algorithm for general purpose people photography is night and day better. Just absolutely huge. If it's just staged portraits, might not matter as much. Still good, but you know, it would be better. But I found that this is going to be usable in a lot more scenarios for like street kind of photography than I would have been able to do with the OM-1 original model.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that. I think that's
no. And if you're photographing dance or anything like that with a lot of movement, it's a wonderful improvement.
Now, they've talked about updating some of the algorithms potentially for the other subjects. I went out and shot birds. I didn't see too much going on differently. But what I do see is that the camera is now putting the AF subject detection box around the animal's head and eye. They've changed up the viewfinder display of how those squares get represented. Mm-hmm. And that's just better, in my opinion, but it's not a game changer. You know, that's just nice. You know, it's nice to see the camera is detecting a head rather than maybe a body. And I don't know what it was actually doing under the hood before.
I took mine to the local zoo, and I was not photographing birds. The birds weren't out. It was too cold.
Yeah.
But I did a lot of other ones. And, you know, and I've shot them many times with the OM-1. What I saw for the normal animal detection, other than the box representation, seemed to be the same. I didn't perceive an obvious difference.
They did change up the rendering of the AF target where it locks onto things.
But I'm just talking about...
Yeah, as far as performance, I don't think it's too much different. No. Still very responsive, very fast autofocus. I have no problem with that. But I want to talk now about the thing that is a big deal regarding subject detection. And it's a difference between the original camera and this new one. There's an autofocus configuration setting now that discusses how does the AF target area behave once it's locked on to a subject. Mm-hmm. And in the OM-1, the way it behaved was that you had to keep the AF target area more or less touching your subject at all times. Mm-hmm. And there's a difference. So if you wanted to track the subject across a moving subject, whether it was a bird or a squirrel, right? You either had to pan your camera with the subject to keep the little target zone on there, or use a very wide zone. In fact, a lot of people suggested using the, all AF points. When you use all AF points though, sometimes other subjects would draw the interest of the camera and it would switch on you all of a sudden. You're like, what the heck just happened? I was focusing on this. So in the OM-1 Mark II, there's now a setting that allows you to tell the camera when the subject leaves the box, do I stay locked onto it, or do I refocus on the box again? And it's that first option that's awesome. Because what it means is that if your subject is locked on, it tracks it across the viewfinder, regardless of where your original AF zone started.
And getting into another change that's been made, there was a way of doing that on the OM-1, but it didn't work very well. And what it had to do with was while subject detection was on, enabling continuous autofocus plus tracking.
Yeah. And we're going to get to the tracking feature in a second.
Well, I know, but there's a bridge here, and that's why I'm trying to do that bridge. So the way it worked in the past is you could sort of get it to follow the subject out of that initial box if you had CF continuous autofocus plus tracking on. But it really didn't work very well. It wasn't very stable.
It wasn't reliable.
And if you tried just using tracking on its own, it really wasn't good. It wouldn't stick to the subject well. It would potentially jump all over the frame. And that was a long-term problem with Olympus cameras.
So one of the comments from early reviewers, in which we would agree, is that continuous focus plus tracking mode is disabled when you're using subject detection. But that's because with subject detection set up this way, it will automatically track your subject.
And so you don't need it.
So you don't need to do a separate setting to have that enabled. And what I found was from the bird, from the Nature Center the other day, was it works. It works just fine. And it gives you a scenario in which you can use a smaller acquisition pattern to pick a particular bird. I want that bird or not, you know, and then just track it and have the camera stay locked on. There's also a lock on feature on a button, but just using it by itself was fine. And that sort of solves the problem of, wait a minute, I need a wide area to keep my subject in the viewfinder at all times, but now it's getting confused by different subjects and what does the camera do? So I like the idea of a small to medium-sized target that is paired with a tracking so that you can allow the subject, if you can recompose, you can do whatever you want. That's a really good feature.
Yeah, so big improvement in that area. Now, another thing that we'll talk about that has to do with the continuous autofocus plus tracking option is that alone, you know, no subject detection turned on, any type, works much better than it did before. And the way this is a strange thing, because both of us were very familiar with this feature, including it not working and why it can be a useful thing, because we've used it on other cameras that have really strong tracking settings. Sony's in my case, Canon's to a certain extent, with you, Nikon's.
Absolutely.
Their 3D tracking mode. It's just, it can be a very general purpose setting where, you know, it's not an animal. It's not a bird or a train. It could be a rock.
Or a window.
It could be
or
a
whatever,
plant,
a sculpture.
A window, whatever. And you're using this in lieu of focus and recompose. And this is probably not something that translates well in an audio format like we're using. But what it means when it does work is you can just make it your go-to setting for everything. You know, if you use back button focus like we do, you hit that, it focuses, you hold it down while you're reframing. So it takes care of any geometrical problems you have, especially closer up. Then you let go, take the shot. Works great. And you don't have to move, you don't have to use the joystick to move a point around.
We've talked about that before, and
it's
an elegant way of shooting, but it only works if the AF target in this mode with this tracking or whatever you call it is sticky enough to not get confused.
And so now it's pretty darn sticky in the OM-1 Mark II. I think the only critique we would have of it is the area is maybe a little bit large, and it would be better if it were a little bit smaller.
Right. You'd love a true single point here. And
close to that.
Let me just speak to it. You can set the camera to like single point mode, but if tracking is turned on, it's using a wider zone. It just doesn't show you where it is. So but I wouldn't use it for like precise close-ups of things where you've got overlapping subject, because you're gonna find it locking onto the nearest object and you'll be going, what the heck? But for normal everyday shooting, seems to work awfully well. I'm going to keep testing it, but this was something that we both wanted to see improved, and we're both very happy with what happened
here. At least from our experiences so far, and the not great weather that we had to test in, it seems to be working quite well.
But I compared it against the OM-1, and there were times where the same subject on the OM-1, that little tracking box would just start zipping around the viewfinder like it had no clue what it was doing. The Mark II stayed locked on. That in and of itself is very valuable to me as a photographer. Okay. There's a couple other features. Let's talk about, there's two more things we want to get to and why it's useful. Sort of buried in, we'll talk about the new computational feature last, but I want to talk about the one other feature that at least I found useful.
SH2?
So there's these drive modes, and cameras have, you know, continuous high, continuous low, whatever, right? And Olympus has about, or OM system has about a dozen of these modes, you know, whether they're using electronic shutter, whether it's using continuous or single shot, and then how fast does it go? Well, there's a mode called SH2. It's silent continuous shooting. And in the OM-1 original, the first, we can call this the OM-1 the second, SH2, the slowest you could shoot was 25 frames a second. And
which
the idea is, which
is
a lot. And it's, I mean, and then there's some times where some wildlife photographers might find this useful. But that's a lot high frame rate. And when you couple it with the smaller buffer in the original camera, it could lead to some problems. Now, why would you want to shoot in this mode anyway? It wasn't, for me, it wasn't about the 25 frames a second. It's about the viewfinder experience. Because in SH2 mode, it's the most smoothest, non-jittery viewfinder experience I've ever had. Everything stays locked down, especially if you have stabilization enabled with your half press. The shutter doesn't jump between frames. You just push the button and it takes pictures.
There's no blackout.
And it's blackout free. It's really quite nice. Even when I was trying crazy combinations like effective 1200 millimeter effective focal length, nothing would jump. And in the traditional, 15 frame per second or whatever, 10 frames per second, the viewfinder would bounce around between shots, which is really challenging if you're using extreme telephoto focal length. So this SH2 is great. The downside was that it was only 25 frames, or that was as slow as it goes. So now you can slow this down to 12 and a half or 16.7 frames per second. Mm-hmm. Now that doesn't sound like much, but actually it's a pretty big deal, because for a lot of action and wildlife photography, you don't need 25 frames per second. You need 10 to 12.
I have mine set at 12 and a half. And I that is one of the things I tried at the zoo. Worked very well. The only criticism I would have of it is it's not super obvious that you're taking photos.
Right. It doesn't have a viewfinder indicator.
It's quiet.
Yeah.
You can see a little orange icon that shows that files are being written. But it would be nice to have something on the edges that flashed or whatever, like, some other cameras will do.
And you can also use this SH2 mode in the Pro combined with Pro Capture, where you get the pre-burst. Mm-hmm. So very cool. So I think that is, for me at least, something that I will find myself using more. I didn't use that feature much in my OM1 simply because it was just too fast.
Too many images that I just didn't want.
Now you combine that, of course, with a bigger buffer, more memory, it makes everything more usable.
So this is a very good feature.
It is. One other thing to note, though, is if you're doing indoor photography, flicker compensation gets disabled in this mode. So if you're shooting sports under, arc lamps, or, mm-hmm. where you get the flicker, you'll get those weird exposure shifts between frames. So
yeah,
might not be ideal for that scenario. Okay. A lot of people are talking about the new computational feature, the live graduated ND filter. Why would you use this? Well, the obvious answer is, this is what you use in lieu of a grad filter, a physical grad filter that you would place. And what it allows you to do is, you using the command dials, you can move it, you can rotate it. You see a line, which is nice. You see the line where the filter gradation starts. So you can kind of place it in the viewfinder, top, bottom, wherever you might place it. And you get between 1 to 3 stops. And they have soft, medium, and hard edge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's interesting.
It's kind of replicating the old experience with the physical filters.
Correct.
And my biggest problem anymore.
Right. My biggest problem with the physical NDs was that getting the gradient placed correctly was hard. So I will say that the live grad ND, it's much easier to place the gradient. But again, if you've got mountains and irregular foregrounds, you're going to have the same problem as you would have with a regular grad ND, which is things get dark that shouldn't be. So you can put them in the post and you have to lighten things up potentially or whatever. And who knows, maybe that's an idea. But the other thing about using a grad filter, a physical grad filter, was that it had one advantage. If it had one advantage, it was that it allowed you to capture everything in a single exposure. So if you had a moving foreground object or something or whatever, if something was moving, it's no big deal because you were only capturing a single frame. This feature, you're capturing kind of like what you're doing with the live ND. You're capturing or the high res mode. You're capturing multiple frames and the camera is blending them together computationally. So if you've got moving objects in the foreground, they're going to have ghosts. They're going to be kind of weird. So could it work? Yes, it does work. It's actually, it does what it purports to do. You know, it does what it claims. I don't see myself personally using it, except at very mild settings, potentially.
One of the reasons I wouldn't, you know, we talked about that transition and how it's awkward if you have things like mountains or sea stacks or anything that juts up in front of the sky that you want to darken a bit. It just kind of falls apart. And it's baked in. So the choice I make while shooting, I'm kind of stuck with in that raw file. Whereas if I were to just put the camera on, you know, high speed advance rate, take two shots,
auto bracket. One,
yeah, just with a two stop difference, I have tremendous flexibility in post processing. I can do something very similar to what a traditional grad filter would do in an incredibly easy fashion, or I could blend them in HDR if I wanted. I probably wouldn't, but I could. I could even do it all by hand. And the important point is I would have tremendous flexibility in how that exposure was blended into the image and where.
Right.
So now, to me, this only makes sense if you're a pure JPEG shooter that doesn't want to do any post-processing.
Right. And there probably are people like that. So there I am not saying this is a feature that shouldn't have happened, because it's a cool feature. But the way I shoot, and most likely the way you shoot, I don't see myself using it too much. Will I use it? I'll play with it. I'll want to see. But unlike the high res capture, which gives you the high resolution merge file plus a single original image from the base exposure at the native resolution, this one does not. So you're going to have that grad filter baked in, and it can make certain things look funny. On the other hand, if you've got nice straight horizon lines, it could work great. So you know, it's just one of those things you'll have to experiment with.
So for me, I think the camera, the Mark II, has some very nice improvements in several areas. The human face and eye detection that we talked about, the way that tracking is handled of subjects outside of the detection area, the improved tracking function. Those are all really good things. I think one of the things that we were curious to find too was this a situation where the sum was greater than it appeared from all of its parts? Because we've experienced that before with new cameras, where they were a little bit deceptive. If you looked at the features, they weren't that exciting, but they really added up to a much nicer camera to shoot with.
Here's what I would say. If you just look at the list of differences, it doesn't look compelling as an upgrade to someone who owns an OM-1 right now. But the advantages of the use case for certain kinds of photography are extremely compelling, because they work so much better. And we've said it before, your camera should be fun to use, right? It should be, you shouldn't feel like you're fighting the system. And but these improvements make the camera.
These are very good improvements. But to me, it isn't one of those situations where it becomes a magical combination and everything is better. They're nice improvements to selected functions. But yeah.
Well, at the end of the day, who should we recommend this to? Because I think the feature set themselves are very good for some specific kinds of photography. Mm-hmm. So I think if you're a bird and animal photographer, the Mark II is the answer.
Especially birds.
Right, because you're going to get more keepers. If you do casual photos of people where face and eye detection is helpful, it's really improved. I mean, night and day better.
Think little kids scurrying around.
If you got grandkids or something, which a lot of you do, this can make your life a lot easier compared to the original one. On the other hand, if you're a landscape shooter, shoot large, fairly static wildlife subjects, moose or something, whatever, or just more studio controlled portraits, I don't know how much it would be benefit. You could save some money by not.
If you already owned an OM-1, I would say think hard.
Right. Now,
You may not need all of those features.
Right. On the other hand, again, if you are in a if you're in a place where you're either coming into the system new and you want to shoot wildlife, or you have an older OM system Olympus camera and you want to upgrade, I think it's worth the extra money to just go ahead and get the Mark II if you have it, because it's a couple hundred dollars difference. You know, again, if those subjects are what you are interested in shooting, the fast moving action type stuff.
And at least theoretically, I'll use that term because of our more recent experience, there should be more firmware updates and upgrades coming out to it. I will be very disappointed if after this whole thing, they do the same thing that they did with the OM1 and cut off upgrades way too early.
Yeah. And there's already, you know, there's always going to be room for improvement. So we hope that, you know, it is what it is. So, you know, I don't want to tiptoe around that too much, but
when I first talked about the OM1 in a podcast, you know, a long time ago, because I had one like a year before you did, at least.
Oh, easily.
You know, the comment I made is very nice, but it feels like it's one to two major firmware improvements away from where it really needs to be. And I think that was an accurate comment. The problem is they've shown up in the Mark II.
Right.
So you just have to figure out what your thoughts are about that.
Well, you know, I got mine as to test from my friends at B&H. Mm-hmm. Big shout out to them for allowing me to try the camera. Within about 10 minutes of playing with the functions that I wanted to test, which are the ones we talked about today, mm-hmm. I knew I would be keeping it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just, for me, it was, you know, do I want to spend another money? Not really, but I would find myself going back to the OM1 and going, oh man, I really want to shoot, especially for the wildlife. So for me, it's an easy one. I knew I would use that, and then I'll have my OM1 as a backup camera, which is still mm-hmm. an awesome backup camera that it never hurts. So
it remains very nice.
I wasn't sure in your case if you would want to end up buying one or not, but it sounds like you are enjoying the overall experience of using it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's all we got. If you've made it this far, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to check out our blog over at imagedoctorsphoto.com. That is premium content for our show supporters, or show sponsors, I should say, which you can sign up for right there. Then you'll get access to things like our bonus videos, as well as blogs and how-to, and even photo critiques or review, depending on your level of membership. So we appreciate it. Until next time, happy shooting.
All right. Bye-bye.